Welcome to The Weekly. I'm Jeremy.
I'm Chris.
And this week on The Weekly. So for headlines, we have Fantasy Flight Miniatures Games changes hands. Disney branded board games. And hashtag Disney must pay.
Oh, yeah. That last one I know. Yeah.
And then our topic is video games and tabletop role playing.
Okay.
Kind of their incestuous history.
I'm interested in one of those.
Nice. So let's start with Fantasy Flight. So Atomic Mass Games, I guess last year, produced the Marvel Crisis Protocol, which is, yeah. I
vaguely remember that. Okay.
So they are now inheriting all of the, because Asmodee manages Fantasy Flight now. They're giving all of the management of their miniatures games to one company.
What other miniatures games did Fantasy Flight have? Because I was kind of only vaguely interested in the board games for a while, and then Android Netrunner. Didn't really pay attention to their RPGs, but I know they have Genesis and paid like no attention to their miniatures game. So I don't even know what they have.
It's all Star Wars. Mostly they're Star Wars
properties. Oh, right. Okay. Yeah.
So X-Wing, Legion, and Armada are going to all go over. So those are big IPs. And since they already handled Marvel, I guess they think they can handle Star Wars as well. And I'm not sure. I don't know if it's a good or a bad sign. I don't know if it's going to change the game because it seems like, especially if they're trying to maintain a competitive, you know, scene with X-Wing. Right. They're just handing it off to another company that is going to be doing the rules as well now? I don't know. If they're going to... Maybe if it's just the production...
Right. Did it say whether it's production or...
It just said they're handing everything over. Yeah, so... Well,
that kind of sounds like everything since they said everything.
Right.
So I know X-Wing is up to like a second edition. Mm-hmm. Played a fair amount of the first edition. Forgot that would have been considered a war game or a miniatures game, but...
They got that going on, so we'll see what happens. But they're very enthusiastic. I don't know anything about the Atomic Mass, but they say it's full of veterans, so hopefully
Doesn't mean it's good.
Yeah, I know. People that just left other companies because they...
Or just people who are old.
Yeah, right.
Well, okay, they said veterans, not seniors. Right. So, yeah.
People seem to be pretty excited about it because they like this company and they say, yeah, that there's industry veterans in it that might do something good. So we'll have to see. I don't trust Fantasy Flight anymore after what they did with Netrunner. So,
well, look, we discussed before. Possibly not their fault. I mean, WotC just could have said, no, you don't get the contract anymore.
Yeah, right.
So, I mean, and there's pretty much nothing Fantasy Flight could do if that is what happened.
Right.
Or,
but it's too many of their living card games just bit it just suddenly. Yeah.
Well, is that... Fair enough. But is that them or is that just like the living card game format?
It might be. It might be that business model. It's just like it needs to have an end and they don't want it. They don't want it to end because they need to kind of finish it up and make a complete game instead of continually adding mechanics. So you can't really follow that Magic the Gathering kind of idea where you just keep evolving and keep doing mechanics in a living card game because eventually you'll lose the license or you start to lose your player base to other competitive games. And then it just sputters.
Yeah. Or if you do follow that Magic format, can you call it a living card game anymore? No, you can't. You've now moved on to collectible card game.
Yeah, right. Yeah, we did a thing, we did a while back, a few years ago, about the kind of the living card game format, and that was before the death of Netrunner, and it did seem like, wow, this is not sustainable because you can't keep introducing. You have to basically have one living card game, because if you compete with yourself with a Game of Thrones and then a Call of Cthulhu or whatever.
Do you? You think so? And not to retread old ground, but I don't think I was on that one. But I think if the IPs, because it's plural, and the mechanics were different enough, you might be able to sustain like two or three. Because like Game of Thrones, Legend of the Five Rings, they had for a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Not that great. And Android, Netrunner. Those are all pretty different. And then if you toss in the Call of Cthulhu one, which I've not looked at.
Right.
So I don't know how different the mechanics are, but those seem like they would appeal to different audiences of people. You might get like some crossover just from people who like to play card games, but those seem distinct enough.
Yeah, but I think for competitive play, which is I think their bread and butter that regularly sells the cards, people don't care about the IP as much as the game.
That's fair.
Yeah,
that's
they learn the game. So yeah, I don't know. It's a weird thing, and they're obviously proving that it's not very sustainable.
Yeah, no, good point. Because not that I was ever like tournament level Magic, but like prior to coming to Japan, I was heavily involved in like the tournament scene at Magic, at least local level. Could not care less what was on the card other than the mechanics.
Right.
Like story did not matter. What does the card do?
Yes.
That's all I care about.
Right. And hopefully things will improve, but I think the management of Asmodee is already hurt Fantasy Flight. I don't see a bright future, but we'll see. And they must have so many things in the queue, though. It doesn't really, nothing's going to really take effect. There's probably so many things in production and everything. There's not going to be a big effect for probably a couple of years. Have you noticed there's a lot of Disney branded board games?
I have not. Possibly because I have subconsciously at least been staying away from them.
But I'm not talking about like Candyland or Monopoly.
That's Disney branded?
I mean, there are. I'm sure there are. Oh, okay. Yeah. I'm sure like, you know, there's a Disney version of every kid's game.
Yeah, fair. Yeah.
There is a very strange list of Disney branded games. So they have a Codenames version, a Disney themed Codenames version, a Infinity Gauntlet Love Letter game. Which I don't know.
Sorry,
you send a love letter to Thanos. I'm not sure exactly what you're doing.
Okay.
Splendor version of Marvel version of Splendor. So,
what are you mining? That's the gem mining game.
Yeah, it's Infinity Stones. To stop Thanos, you're mining Infinity Stones as a gem merchant. I have no idea.
Or at least there is a tenuous connection there, but okay.
Right. And then Unlock, which is kind of an escape room game.
Right, right.
Okay. But that's a Star Wars theme, though. So, yes, you know. Not quite Mickey, but
just hire or just pull an R2 to hack the little door panel. Right. Yeah, we're out. Okay, done.
Yeah, easy enough. But I was surprised. So does that mean that, is this kind of affirming that these are classic board games? Because, you know, that how they keep rebranding Monopoly with every IP under the sun. So when you get a rebrand on something like Splendor or Codenames, it's like, well, I guess that means that's a standard classic board game now that people kind of, you know, see. Because Catan has like a Game of Thrones or something. They do some kind of thing.
Catan might as well be the Monopoly of Euro games. Yeah, whatever. Like, that was fun at first, but after like couple plays, it's like, oh, this game is, no. But that's a good point. And I guess I would agree that, okay, Disney picking up and making a Disney-branded version of this game maybe doesn't necessarily mean the game is now like a staple, but it at least means it's made enough of a splash, kind of mix my metaphors there, for Disney to take notice and say, yeah, we think this is, we want to put this out there again. I think it also means that Disney is just a giant media monopoly and can buy pretty much anything they want.
Right, right. Yeah, so that was surprising. I guess they're taking advantage of the board game trend and kind of licensing out branding for those games. And I guess if they think their games are approachable enough, like Codenames is a pretty approachable game for it, because they have a Codenames Junior.
Is it like a party game where like you can't say a certain word or something?
You kind of lay out. You have to give clues. Yeah, it's similar to a lot of those word party games. You can't say the word, and you're trying to get people to pick from a grid of Codenames. So it's interesting to see that, because, you know, a lot of these games were really adopted by the kind of board game craze, and now they're going to start getting rebranded. So we may see all kinds of strange Harry Potter and Alien, whatever.
Oh, yeah. No. It couldn't be Harry Potter because Disney doesn't own that, does it?
No. But you know,
it could be Alien.
Yeah, that's right. It can be Alien.
Alien Codenames, Alien Love Letter, Alien Splendor. I think it's more just Disney saying, what's the cheapest way for us to get into board games is to not make them. And I'm not saying they couldn't or that they would be good or bad or whatever, but just let's buy the license to that game and slap some new Disney artwork on it.
Right.
Because much like role-playing game nerds, Disney nerds will buy anything with Disney.
Yeah, they'll collect, anything. And I guess it's, you know, kind of legitimizing, you know, board game night with the family and stuff. That's kind of a relic, you know, of a bygone era. So get them off their screens and devices and sitting at an analog table. That's not, can't be a bad thing, right?
No, yeah, you're right. That can't be all that bad.
But hashtag Disney must pay. There's a little bit of a problem involved in the Disney's purchase of the Star Wars property.
Star Wars.
And eventually Alien, but originally Star Wars. Someone that you probably know, an author, has written a letter. And this letter goes, "Dear Mickey, we have a lot in common, you and I. We share a birthday, November 18th. My dad's name was Mickey, and there's a lot more."
That means there isn't. Sorry to editorialize, but that usually means I have reached the end of the things that are the same about us. Yeah.
"When you purchased Lucasfilm and acquired the rights to some of the books that I wrote, Star Wars, the novelization of their very first film, Splinter of the Mind's Eye, the first sequel novel, you owe me royalties on those books, and you stopped paying them. When you purchased 20th Century Fox, you eventually acquired the rights to other books I have written, the novelizations of Alien, Aliens, and Alien 3. You've never paid royalty on any of those, or even issued royalty statements for them. Yeah. All of these books are still very much in print, and you still earn money for you. So when one company buys another, they acquire the liabilities as well as the assets, and you are certainly reaping the benefits of these assets. I'd very much like my minuscule, although not small to me, share. you want me to sign an NDA before talking. And I've signed a lot of NDAs in my 50-year career, but never before did anyone ask me to sign one prior to negotiations. So it continues and goes on basically saying, you know, this is not okay. You know, you took over the rights to this. And Disney's position is we bought the assets, not the liabilities.
I don't see that. Like, okay. I went to art school. Right. I suck at math and pretty much everything else. I don't really see how that's defensible. I mean, like, if you buy a company, you kind of buy everything, right? I mean, like, it's different from, like, I don't know, like buying a department, right? Or like we were just talking about with, like, Fantasy Flight Games. You're like, okay, this chunk of the company, we're giving it to this other company.
Right.
So, like, there you might have a leg to stand on to say that, like, okay, all these other debts accrued by, like, the other parts of the company, we didn't get those.
Right.
So those aren't ours. Just the section we got is ours. But if you buy a whole company, right. I really don't see how you can cherry pick and say, we own the good parts, not the bad parts.
Yeah. So, and if you didn't know who I was talking about, that's Alan Dean Foster. Right. Yeah. He's a prolific writer of a lot of novelizations of, you know, very famous movies. And I think, did he work? Oh, no, it was Terry Brooks worked on the prequel trilogy. And
I haven't read them, but I'm pretty sure Alan Dean Foster has also written original stuff.
Yes. Oh, yeah, of course. Yeah. He's 50 years of a lot of writing. So this is a shame, too. And especially stiffing someone, you know, that's worked with that IP for so long. They must have a lot of faith in their, you know, legal team. Yeah.
I don't know if I was going to say, I don't know if they have a lot of faith in their legal team. They have a lot of money.
Yeah. Right.
Which is kind of the only thing that really matters.
Right. And yeah, so, and this is not a young author, so they could probably put the legally fight this off until he was, you know, beyond his estate would have to continue the fight. So that's pretty
either shady. That or I have no idea what Alan Dean Foster's, like, how much he's worth or what his financial situation is, but it ain't Disney. So Disney could, like, wait for him to die or just make it too expensive to continue. And that would set a pretty horrible precedent for people creating media.
Yeah, for copyright. Yeah, definitely, because that would mean if Disney gets away with this, anything they acquire in the future, they're going to, all liabilities, they're just going to deny. Yeah, so if they start eating things up, they know that, yeah, it's a one-time purchase. There's nothing else, no other maintenance involved. So it was pretty disappointing.
But is it out of character? Really?
Not really, no. Yeah. Disney is, does. I mean, that's a very, it's so funny that they're, you know, they're kind of public image and they're,
is,
you know,
a fucking cartoon mouse.
But they're, you know, the happiest place on earth and all of that. And then what they do behind the scenes, like the skirmishes they've had with, like, the LA Times and how they defend their reputation and what they've done to Anaheim, like the original Disneyland is not doing great things for the city of Anaheim.
Not to mention copyright.
Yeah, right. And so then, yeah, when you talk to people that have done work for them and then have not been compensated.
Really kind of back to Netrunner. When we started playing Netrunner, like the media corporation, NBN, I'm like, these people don't sound so bad. Then I'm like figuring out, like, oh man, Disney's a real bunch of assholes, aren't they? Oh, I totally get how owning all the information on everybody ever and making all this entertainment. You're like probably the worst corp in this setting, and you're just Disney with the serial numbers filed off and a yellow coat of paint. Yeah.
Yeah, so we'll see how that turns out. I mean, hopefully they'll do the right thing, but, you know,
it's Disney.
Yeah, and they own Marvel now, and Marvel always does the wrong thing as in regards to, you know, older creators that, you know, made characters for them. So we will see.
I'm not expecting a positive outcome.
No, not at all. So for our topic this week, I wanted to talk a little bit about, and I think this is interesting. There's a lot of kind of mixed, you know, a lot of mixed issues and a lot of sharing. So, like I called it incestuous, I think the development of both tabletop and
tell us
PC,
how you really feel.
And PC, they've shared a lot of things and kind of influenced each other in positive and negative ways. And there's some things that, you know, you can do better on the tabletop than you can do on a computer.
Right.
And we're kind of seeing that. So just a kind of a real quick history, and this is skipping a lot of stuff. If you're going to talk about, like, the original PC RPGs, you'd have to talk about the multi-user dungeons, the text-based kind of MUDs. Yeah. So that was the first kind of, you know, there's a fantasy setting and there are things going on. Of course, there was a huge range of genres, but they do have, I mean, it's called a dungeon, but it's not, it doesn't mean dungeon.
You wouldn't. I was just curious because, like, I got into computers late, secondhand computer, and got, like, Wizardry and, like, what was it, like, Bard's Tale and the Ultima games on the 5 and the whatever quarter floppies. And I was just wondering, would you also consider those RPGs?
Yes.
Like, they were single player, But you were kind of like tromping through a dungeon and you had a little party and stuff.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, so those are definitely the earliest. Yeah, Wizardry, Ultima, everything were the earliest. And they evolved some of those things, or they took some of those things from the tabletop that we like now recognize as just kind of standard, whether it's a PCRPG or it's a tabletop. And so, yeah, so you just basically named kind of the early predecessors. And I think it really didn't, things didn't really come together. And there's a, you know, you can argue this every which way, but I think things didn't really come together as far as recreating D&D accurately on the tabletop until Baldur's Gate.
Okay.
Yeah, so I think the first Baldur's Gate, because I was basically using the exact mechanics, right, for better or worse, because now they're up to Baldur's Gate 3 just came out. And so people that are not connected, some maybe didn't play the original or know the title or only played kind of, you know, modern D&D, they don't like the random number generation, kind of the dice rolling mechanic that's going on, because it creates so much randomness. And we know, like, from, you know, anybody that's played D20, you have a huge range of failure and incredible success and incredible failure. And that it's a little jarring if you're used to kind of building momentum in these games where you're attacking, you're getting buffs and bonuses and, you know, kind of the things that MMOs have.
I was kind of wondering, do you think it's then people who are coming from MMOs where maybe they know, I'm not a video gamer, but if you're coming from MMOs, you probably have a decent idea of your character's capabilities,
right?
Because that's kind of what you're supposed to do. The focus, I think, is more on ability rather than actually role-playing,
right?
For at least for an MMO. Yeah. Yeah, no, so if people are coming from MMOs and then going to something like Baldur's Gate and, for lack of a better term, they roll a one or the computer rolls a one for them, right? I hadn't really heard that, but then again, I'm not in video game circles. So people are getting kind of upset or jarring or taking time to adjust to that kind of different mechanic.
Yeah, yeah. The character just failing something, because it's, you know, turn-based combat. And so you just have turns where your whole party just botches and just like, okay, how is this? How is this supposed to work? Like, what story are we telling here? And so those are some of the things that are a little bit frustrating. So I'll just go through kind of a list of things that were kind of developed and shared between tabletop, and most of them going from tabletop to PC, because PCs were kind of trying to emulate a lot of what was happening in the analog world. So of course, storytelling is the first thing. And that really didn't, you know, early computers couldn't really do that. They could do it a little bit with text, but as we got more developed, we have, you know, cinematics and like little 3D scenes and then very branching, you know, paths. So it simulated a kind of storytelling, even if it was a little bit limited. So player character stats and persistent inventory, that started to become a thing that reflected what you could do on the tabletop in class and race, world maps. One of the things that more recently happened, and I think because people are playing more with alignment systems and using not only alignment, but background and different ideas about how characters should be role played, is morality system. Okay. So in games, though, so far, it's been kind of a binary morality system. So good and bad. Yeah, you just get good points or bad points, and it kind of opens up dialogue options or closes things off, or, you know, changes how people react to you based on what you've done. On the PC, it's still kind of simple, but those are things that definitely the tabletop is kind of, you know, playing around with, is how to make things gray or make things more interesting and not just lawful good versus chaotic evil. And then, of course, the thing that probably came more from computer gaming and then also maybe arcade gaming is, you know, leveling and experience, you know, building your character up over time. And that's become something that's so standard now that is really satisfying for people in the PC world. They want to create, you know, a superhero kind of, like, they go from level one and create this incredibly competent character. And so some of that is kind of spilling into, maybe poisoning a little bit, what people want to do on the tabletop. They're just thinking about character development.
I don't know. Because like I said, I'm coming at this more from the tabletop RPG side, because even though I started with, you know, like, not Quark, but, you know, Wizardry, and actually thinking about what you said, like, your entire party whiffs, right? In a tabletop role-playing game like Dungeons & Dragons, with a person running the game, that could have taken like 15 minutes.
Right.
And I understand why that would be very unsatisfying. And that's not meant to be a dunk on D&D, like, because other games do it as well, right? Any kind of turn-based game, if everybody misses and you have that binary pass-fail thing, it's going to be 15 minutes of an unsatisfying combat. In Wizardry, back in the day on the Commodore 64 in the darkened computer room, everybody misses, took like a minute, right? A minute tops. Yeah, yeah. And then you saw the results of missing, which was losing a chunk of hit points and maybe having to decide whether you're going to continue the fight or run from the dungeon, you know? So if there was a way to do that turn-based, it would be a PC game.
Right.
Because you can calculate it so much faster than a person.
Yeah, yeah.
And from being more on like the story side of mm-hmm. tabletop RPGs, there is a distinct group of tabletop RPG players who want that class and leveling system, who kind of, even if it's not every session, who like that's what they care about, mm-hmm. watching their character grow. So I don't think it's only PC game people or video game people who want to do that.
No, I think that's true. I think like as your character advances and getting, you know, more and more skills and becoming more competent, more competent, the kind of feedback loop that people get conditioned by, I think, came from PCs because it's so much a slower development. In the tabletop experience.
And especially if you're having that entire round of everybody with it.
And I think a lot of that frustration with missing, you know, with actually having you fail an attack comes from action RPGs because they have some of those similar systems, but you're attacking 10 times a second. You're just swinging a sword again and building up this energy and releasing these attacks. When it's turn-based on the PC, it's a lot of slower. And if you have a couple of rounds of everybody missing, you're like, what am I sitting here for? You know, it does feel just because you're getting conditioned for the PC for it to be a faster experience. And I think that, and that's a much newer phenomena. Yeah, so things like, I think another kind of unhealthy thing is the min-maxing that happens with people that are really used to tweaking characters and doing perfect builds on the PC of characters to do the most damage or be the most effective. If they want to do that on the tabletop, it takes a lot away from the story. Like an incompetent character, a character with bad stats, it might be a lot more fun to play than a super competent character because... And I think that just comes from, you know, having an interest in the maths of the game and just trying to kind of, you know, so min-maxing is kind of the equivalent of like hacking the game or beating the game. Like, I've figured this out. I've broken the system and I know how to make the strongest barbarian ever.
I am going to lose so much nerd credit because I forget the keys for the God mode cheat and doom. It's what like IDGF something, something for the, because that's what I thought about hacking. You are backing me into a corner where I am going to have to defend min-maxing. I don't appreciate that. Where it's like, okay, like I don't enjoy it, but there are different ways to enjoy a role-playing game. And sometimes that includes knowing the rules so well or pouring through the rules so closely that you find all the kind of the combinations to build the best barbarian ever or your character does this certain thing incredibly well.
Right.
To the detriment of other stuff, but there's been a bunch of discussions about min-maxing, where min-maxing in tabletop RPGs isn't inherently bad or wrong. Like, it's kind of come to mean players who dump everything into one or make their character be able to do one thing really well at the expense of everything else, and then kind of possibly disrupt the game to make that situation pop up very often.
I need to get into melee range.
But that's not what it has to be, right? Min-maxing just means I am putting everything in this area of the character and ignoring that area of the character. And I've seen some really good arguments about how as long as you then kind of play that character and I guess kind of roll with the punches, right? Like if you make that smashy barbarian who can't talk, but then don't automatically go to like fighting, but actually then kind of try to talk away. That could be really fun.
Oh yeah, definitely.
And yeah, so I don't think min-maxing is inherently bad, but there's certainly less of a consequence in PC or video games because there's not going to be those other people at the table giving you, I guess, for lack of a better term, negative feedback.
Right.
So,
and in most cases, it's like a MMO, people will appreciate you being super powerful. They're like, oh, so glad you're in the party. You saved, you know, you saved us that that battle.
Yeah. If you have a whole table of people who are like that, I mean, that is what table is supposed to be, right?
No, I think that's a good point. If every player is doing that, that's a very fun experience because they're getting what they want to out of the game.
For those people. For those people.
right. And they're not having, you know, we're not telling a story. We're not play acting. I'm not worried about the voice of my character. I'm just kicking ass with my amazing, amazing build of my character. But when it's mixed, and I think some people are trying to role play and play like how their character is built, and a lot of that was randomly generated and not ideal. And and other players that are just like, no, I'm not going to talk because I'm bad at talking.
I'm not going to talk.
I'm bad at talking. I'm punch only. Yeah. But I think that's a good point. I mean, there's all kinds of ways to appreciate stuff. So some of the more modern developments in tabletop I wanted to ask you about. So what do you think about things like dice rolling apps? Because as we're getting like more RPGs with specialized dice, not everyone's going to have them. And so you can download the app and then roll the funny dice and be able to
interpret the chicken entrails.
So you can do that. Do you think that's a good thing, or does it take away from actually being at a table with paper and pencils? And
hard to say, because I'm the person who likes being at a table with actual physical books and paper and pencil and interacting with other people. Mm-hmm. But that's not always possible. So I understand why dice apps exist. Mm-hmm. And it certainly is, in some situations, easier to just tap a couple buttons and have them roll those chicken bone dice.
Right.
And sometimes even like interpret or at least tally up the symbols or whatever for you. Yeah. So that is accessibility, and mm-hmm. not everyone has access to physical dice or is able to use physical dice. Yeah, so while I don't use them, mm-hmm. I don't dislike them because I understand the need of why they would exist.
Right. And so what about something like laptops at the table? Like,
I've recently come around to that if fellow players in our group are listening, Alan and John using laptops mm-hmm. either to record notes mm-hmm. during a session or while they were emceeing a session was kind of the first time I had seen people do that mm-hmm. or experienced it. And it's just another way of taking notes.
Right. That's true. And as long as they're not like, you know, checking their Twitter or whatever, you know, during the session while they're waiting and getting...
You don't need a laptop to do that.
And getting distracted. No, I think that's good because you do have, when you have somebody kind of, you know, scribing the whole session and being able to share it so instantly digitally, that's a huge benefit, especially if you have an irregular meeting schedule. Yeah, so you can remind yourself very easily.
Oh, yeah.
Everybody on a laptop might be a little odd, but if someone is kind of, you know, someone's... And I mean, it's useful too for like, especially how John, when John was running Monster Hearts and he was basically everything we were saying.
Well, that's because he was writing a novel. Sorry, yeah. I was going to say that's because we were basically running the game ourselves. But that sounds like John didn't do anything, which was not the case.
No.
But that's like a very player-driven game where you can just kind of set a situation and mm-hmm. then the players will have their characters interact. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I think we all had a really good handle on the system. And so we would kind of, and it's a very player, Monster Hearts is a very player-facing game where a lot of the rules you need are kind of, and the results of those rules are kind of right there. Mm-hmm. And so a game like that, I think it is a lot easier for the MC or whoever's running the game to record happening or mm-hmm. what's happening as the players are going through, as opposed to a more GM heavy game where a lot more relies on them to drive the story.
Yeah, that was more a compliment to John's typing speed.
But
I thought that was really great because that gave him between each sessions the ability to kind of like see what story we were telling and like, okay, this is what direction I'm going to go. And it's not for all audiences.
Yeah. No, it's not.
And just like you have to talk about that in terms of anything, people, things that are going to be triggering for people or whatever. So player expectation, and especially now knowing that some players are going to come to the table only having PC RPG experience, and that's going to change what they want to get out of the game. So it's a good thing to keep in mind because games really do, PC games, especially more recently with cash shops where they're trying to get you to buy things.
Microtransactions.
right. It is more of a weird kind of Skinner box where you just like tap the button, get the goodies. And mobile is even worse, you know, if you're doing anything on mobile.
I'm half laughing because there's been talk in indie RPG Twitter, not seriously, about how to cash in on that microtransaction.
Well, it's becoming so normalized now. I mean, I remember the beginning of that. It's like, what? You spend $1 to what? An XP boost for an hour? That's insane. But now
mobile games like, speed this process up, with X coins.
We're going to make it excruciating. Yeah. But if you'd like to give us $1.99.
That's how you can do it. I can do it. Like in D&D, hey, everyone kick in $1. And I'll end the round, right?
That's right.
We'll move on to the next round.
It looks like your character's going to die, unless...
Yeah. Wow. Yeah.
Yeah, you become the equivalent of the arcade game of the 80s.
That's pretty funny. Yeah,
just pump in quarters.
Death check. That's a quarter. You can pass it.
Right.
I'm actually going to write that up now.
All right. Yeah, so I thought that was kind of a fun topic to kick back and forth because the developments are very shared. And I think they've been, like if you look at 4th edition D&D, that was like really paying attention to how people are thinking differently.
And apparently it didn't work.
Right? They didn't know. They didn't. Maybe none of them were actually players. They were just kind of translating. So that is all for this week. Ooh. So where can people find you?
On Twitter, as always, where I am doing what now? I don't know. Complaining about having a kid and... That's about it.
Nice. Yeah, your question from a couple of weeks ago got a few comments. The last time I was live streaming
cartoon. Nice. Yeah,
they said, oh, well, I don't know.
I'll have to come up with some more then. Drive interaction.
Yeah. It was good starting out with a kinky little question. will be back next week. And if you'd like to find more of this podcast, please go to utterredhands.com. And we're also on YouTube. So subscribe. And I guess it's the first video. Yeah. So if you're actually seeing us, this is how this looks. Yeah, yeah. This is what lunchtime looks like after the food has been cleared away.
Yeah. Corporate. I haven't even eaten corporate drone here. Yeah. All right.
All right. So see you next week.
Later, mortals.
Bye.